Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural episode, the very first actual real episode of Found Objects podcast. If you guys came from the intro episode before this, you would know all the inner workings, all the questions answered about why this podcast is the way it is, why it's called what it is, why it's named what it is, why just everything about it is in the intro episode. So if you guys have any questions, please kindly go listen to that because your questions will be answered. And here we are in episode one. But before we get into all that, I do want to properly welcome you in. Where are my manners? Hello. Hi, I'm Katie, Katie Bilotti. And this is my new baby, my new podcast, Found Objects, first episode. Hope you guys are doing well. I haven't actually figured out what my intro is going to be. Like every week will probably have a pretty similar intro of like what I say. I haven't figured that out yet. So this is what you've got for now. But every episode will be going live on Wednesdays, or rather every Wednesday, there will be a new episode of this podcast in the morning. So hopefully that works with you because that's what works for me. So yeah, I mean, I'm thrilled to get started and I feel very lucky. Like I haven't even posted it yet at this point that I'm recording this, but I feel very grateful that you all are here. So just thank you from the bottom of my heart for believing in me, for caring about history. Like it's cool to meet other people that care about the same weird stuff that I care about. So that's you. Thank you for being here. I just want to say that before we get into it. Because I have a feeling, I don't know how this is going to go, but I have a feeling we might have a long road together. And if you feel like it, if you want to rate me 5 stars, if you think I'm 5 stars material, or leave a review, I'd be very grateful. And with that, let's get into it. Okay, so I want you and I to imagine ourselves in a particular scenario that kind of sets the mood for this story. So imagine it's a Wednesday, it's a workday Wednesday, you wake up in the morning, you look outside, and there's a blue sky. And you're like, wait a minute, I thought the forecast said that it was supposed to be rainy and disgusting today. So you know what? I'm in a great mood. Like, it's this unexpected blue sky day. I know I have to go to work, but I'm in a good mood. I woke up on the right side of the bed today and I'm ready for my coffee. I'm gonna go downstairs or wherever your coffee machine is and make myself my favorite coffee with that creamer I like just going through my morning ritual, excited about the day. That first sip of coffee, we all know it's healing, it's orgasmic, it's the best thing ever. I oftentimes go to bed at night the night before thinking and dreaming about my coffee the next morning. Like I'm like honestly very excited to drink my coffee in the morning. So imagine you're going in for that very first sip. You're so excited about this day. It's going to be fabulous. You drop coffee all down the front of you. Like you fumble this cup of coffee and it just goes all over your perfect work outfit, this outfit that you have meticulously picked out for this specific day. You've been saving it for that perfect work day, and you thought this was it because, you know, the blue sky gave you the indication that it was going to be a great day, and you just spilled coffee all over yourself. So you take a deep breath. You think to yourself, okay, that's a bummer. It's okay. I'll put on one of my other various work outfits that I've worn a gazillion times. It's fine. We'll put that on. And you know what? As a treat for myself, because girl math, because I lost this coffee, I deserve a drive-through coffee. So let's get out of here and go get a drive-through coffee. You're like, it's fine. Just one bad thing. Like I can still salvage this day. You get in your car, you get a mile from home towards that coffee shop, and you hear a pop. You look out your window and your mood just sinks even lower when you realize you've popped your tire. and you have no idea how to change a tire because, of course, like, who pays attention when their dad or whoever is teaching them how to change a tire? Like, I certainly was not paying attention. Gun to my head, could not tell you how to change a tire. So you're instantly deflated yet again when you have to call AAA to come rescue you. And as that's happening, you're like, oh my God, I'm going to be late for work. So you have to call your boss and try to explain the situation. And you're like, you know what? Surely my boss will understand. How could I have planned this? This is a crazy slew of events happening to me. Like, they will have to understand. Your boss picks up and nonchalantly informs you that you've been let go. Like, you no longer have a job to go to. So you're processing this news. You're processing all of these unfortunate events that happened to you one after the other. And you think to yourself, what did I do to deserve this? Or who can I blame for this? You just want to blame someone. I mean, we've all been there when even just one thing goes wrong. We're like, you know, who can I blame for this? Because it sucks to blame yourself, you know? It's just never something you want to do. And so the first instinct is to consider all other possibilities, you know? Like, this isn't fair. I don't deserve this. You ask yourself, is this a stroke of bad luck, a series of unfortunate events, or a curse? And while it may seem a bit dramatic, just a touch dramatic, to jump to a curse to explain these events, the spilled coffee, flat tire, and job layoff, what else could possibly explain such a tragic state of affairs one after another? And that is where the evolution of a curse begins. When nothing else can explain a predicament, the only logical explanation is that from another place, a higher power, or some divine intervention with a terrible sense of humor. Or, in the case of one of the most infamous curses of all time, the Hope Diamond Curse, it's not God with a terrible sense of humor, it's Pierre Cartier. Yes, that Cartier, the watch, love bracelet, expensive jewelry one, but the original, Pierre Cartier. He crafts the story of a cursed diamond to make a pretty penny. While Cartier definitely embellishes the story to make the sale, as many people do, I mean, come on, that's kind of the oldest trick in the book for sales. It's like, you know, you're going to tell a story. Everyone loves, people love a story. I mean, after all, you're here listening to this one. So people love a story behind what they're going to purchase. So of course, Cartier spun a tale and he might have embellished a bit. But don't be fooled. The diamond has a very rich, very tumultuous history, factually. And that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to tell you the story that Cartier told, and we're going to expose the truths in it and the lies. At the center of our story is, after all, the diamond, the Hope Diamond, which is this brilliant, deep blue diamond that today weighs about 45.5 carats. Imagine just how big that is. I mean, I have photos up on the Instagram. If you guys go to the Found Objects podcast Instagram, you'll see photos of this diamond now and then, because today it's 45.5 carats, but it used to be much bigger. If you guys have ever been to the Smithsonian Museum in DC, you might have seen this diamond in the flesh, or in the rock, I guess. I actually saw it when I was a kid. I was on a field trip. We'll talk about this later in the episode because I do want to like give a full spiel about it. But I saw this diamond and I always thought it was remarkable. And then I stumbled across this story of the truth, the curse, and I was blown away. I had no idea. I never thought it had so much history, so much drama behind it. Like, there's a lot of drama behind this rock, okay? Anyway, so the Hope Diamond as we know it today was recut several times over the centuries. The Tavernier blue, which was the diamond in its largest form, was about 115 carats. From there, it was recut into the French blue, and it measured in at about 69 carats. So, if you're following here, the Hope Diamond was originally called the Tavernier blue when it was in its largest form at 115 carats, and then it was renamed the French blue when it measured in at 69 carats, and then today it's called the Hope Diamond at 45.5 carats. So it gradually just went down in size, but still the same stone, just different sizes. And don't you worry, we will definitely be getting into the nitty-gritty of why the diamond was downsized, how the diamond was downsized, and why it was called all of these different things. It's not hard to imagine why the Hope Diamond was the object of such obsession for so many. Its blue color and sheer size is and was mesmerizing, and it was the object of irresistible desire, especially for a woman named Evelyn Walsh McLean. Evelyn and her husband Ned, let's talk about them. They are very interesting characters in our story. They were heirs to great American fortunes. Ned's father owned the Washington Post, if you've ever heard of it, and Evelyn's father was a successful gold miner. In 1910, while the couple was on a trip to Paris, Cartier began planting the seeds with Ned and Evelyn McLean. He had previously sold them the Star of the East Diamond in 1908 while on their honeymoon. So clearly the couple, they had an interest in precious gems and they had the money. So as soon as Cartier bought the Hope Diamond, he pegged the McLeans as potential buyers. He was like, perfect. I know just the people that will want to buy this massive blue diamond. This rich couple, the McLeans. It took 2 years of convincing and elaborate storytelling, but Cartier eventually sold it to the couple in 1912. So Cartier spun this tale about how the Hope Diamond was cursed and Evelyn ate it up. She was like, yes, I need this. I love that this is a cursed stone, which is very interesting to me because, granted, I love a story behind things that I purchase. Like I love antiques. I love when something has a story like, oh, my mom got this for me. I'll wear this, you know, necklace because my mom got it for me. Or, you know, there's like some deeper meaning because, of course, everyone loves a conversation piece. But I don't know how I feel about like walking around with something that I know is cursed, like wearing a necklace that I know is cursed and has been for like centuries. I don't know. I don't know about that. She inherently believed that she was immune to people's bad luck charms and they were, in fact, good luck for her. So Evelyn was DeLulu. She was the OG DeLulu. But honestly, respect, I guess. Like if that's your mentality, to each their own. I think that's honestly a great opportunity to use that phrase, to each their own. Okay, Evelyn, go off. So that story that Pierre Cartier told Evelyn that ultimately made her want to purchase this cursed gem, what was it? What was the story? What sold her? And how much of it was true? Many, many moons ago, around 1660 or so, an explorer by the name of Jean-Baptiste Tavernier made a trip to India in search of precious gems. Like many merchants of the time, he was entranced by the 115-carat blue diamond perched on the statue of the Hindu goddess of Sita. So he decided to steal it. Sounds like an all-around great guy. He saw this blue diamond sparkling in the eyeball socket of a Hindu statue and was like, perfect, I will take that. Thank you very much. Plucked it off and took it, and then vanished into the night. The next morning, when the local Hindu priests realized a diamond was missing, they cast a curse on whoever possessed the stolen gem. Because of course they did. That's a big no-no. Like everyone knows, do not steal from Hindu priests. So, Tavernier brought his treasures from this latest trip to royal courts across Europe in hopes that the wealthy people would snatch them up. King Louis XIV took a particular interest in the massive blue diamond, so he bought it. Unfortunately, shortly after making the sale, the curse took its first victim when Tavernier was torn apart by dogs on a trip to Constantinople. Which, moment of silence, that sounds like a terrible way to go, but I mean, come on, the guy he stole from Hindu priests. What did you think was going to happen? Like, what did you think? Anyway, the diamond was then passed down through multiple generations of the French royal family and was given a new name, the French Blue. King Louis XIV was an absolute monarch, meaning he believed his power was bestowed onto him directly from God. Which, another DeLulu character. Like, first was Evelyn. Well, I guess technically King Louis came before Evelyn, but there's a lot of DeLulu in this story, okay? Like, this is not the last time you will hear me say that. So King Louis thought he was pretty much as good as God. So for that reason, he selected the sun to be his emblem, and the blue diamond was recut to 69 carats, set in gold for the sun, and mounted in a scepter to symbolize the divine power of the king. Imagine having that much money. Like, that is FU money to be able to do that. This is when the French blue was born. King Louis stored it in his cabinet of curiosities at the Palace of Versailles and only took it out for special guests. Despite his exceptionally long reign, the high-revered, seemingly immortal king died of gangrene. The diamond curse had struck again. King Louis XIV was victim number two. One of King Louis's trusted court officials, Nicolas Fouquet, once took the diamond out for a spin. He went to an event and he borrowed the diamond, and shortly thereafter was punished for crimes against the throne. He was banished from France, imprisoned, and executed. He didn't even own the diamond. He was just borrowing it, and he also fell victim to the curse. So this is victim number three. So King Louis XIV, as we know, passed away, and so what happened was his great-grandson, who became Louis XV, inherited the royal jewels when he took the throne. And a little fun fact that I always find interesting when I read about King Louis XV was that he became king at the ripe age of 5 years old. He was five when he became king in 1715 upon the death of Louis XIV, and 3 years prior to Louis XIV's death, his father had passed away. So he was 5 years old. He was the next in line and became king at 5 years old, which is always just so interesting to me. So just a little aside. Anyway, I assume once King Louis XV became old enough to make decrees and such, he tasked a local Parisian jeweler with resetting the French blue. He wanted to make it his own, a little bit different than the previous version of it. He wanted to create an emblem for the knighthood of the Order of the Golden Fleece. And this emblem became one of the most lavish pieces of jewelry ever made. To give a bit of a visual, it kind of looked like a bejeweled badge or medallion that maybe would be worn on a coat. And for context, I do want to explain this because when I first read this, was like, the Golden Fleece? Like, what is that? I think fleece being a fabric or a coat, you know, like not... It just is like a thing to me, like a tangible object, but it wasn't that at all for this time. So the Order of the Golden Fleece was essentially a group of knights. It was kind of like a Soho house or like an elite club for a group of knights, like very special knights, because of course royalty and all was involved. So the emblem involving the French blue and a slew of other gemstones was to commemorate or celebrate this exclusive club of knights. And the badge was rarely worn and more so served as a symbol of the king's altruism and power because, of course, wealth. While King Louis XV was known for being well-beloved early in his reign, he fell out of favor with his people by the time he died in 1774. His downfall set the stage for the upcoming French turmoil that was brewing. So when King Louis XVI ascended to the throne at the age of 20, a little bit more reasonable than 5 years old, he was set up for failure, King Louis XVI, and the so-called cursed French blue diamond was now his, lurking, looming, and ready to take him down. King Louis XVI and his wife, Marie Antoinette, you might have heard of her. I've talked about her a lot on various podcasts in the past. Like, her life was so interesting to me. But King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, they were involved in this story. They struggled, as many of us know, through a reign of distress, uprising, and revolution, and were famously beheaded in 1793. But the diamond's curse did not stop with the two of them. Marie-Louise, Princesse de Lamballe, was a trusted member of Marie Antoinette's court who frequently wore the diamond to high society events. She too suffered at the hands of the diamond when she was imprisoned and then turned over to a French mob who dismembered her, put her head on a spike, and paraded around town with it. Which, that is just such a way to go. Like, yeah, the French Revolution was not for the faint of heart, let me tell you that. The French crown jewels, what happened to them? Because, of course, Marie Antoinette, King Louis XVI, everyone that they knew and loved pretty much died, you know, at the end of this. So what happened to the jewels? So the French crown jewels, including the blue diamond that was now 69 carats, were seized following King Louis XVI's execution and stored in... Okay, bear with me here. This is a French word. It's called the Garde Meb. I think I did that right. Disregard my terrible French pronunciation. What you need to take from this is that the jewels were in this royal storehouse. After everything went down, they were put there for safekeeping. In 1792, the French blue was stolen from this place, from the royal storehouse, and ended up in the hands of a man named Wilhelm Falls. the Dutch jeweler responsible for recutting the French blue to the 45 carats it is today. 45.5, sorry. That 0.5 carats does matter. That's still a lot. After Wilhelm cut down the diamond, the jeweler's son, Hendrik, stole the diamond. So he stole the already stolen diamond, murdered his father, and then committed suicide. The cursed diamond's death toll was just climbing and climbing and climbing. The diamond was then lost for several years before turning up in London in 1812. Its new shape and size made it unrecognizable as the French blue that had gone missing 20 years before, but nonetheless, it ended up in the possession of Philip Hope, which of course sounds familiar because that's the current name of the diamond, the Hope Diamond. This part's important. Mr. Hope was a wealthy British banker with an affinity for shiny, expensive things. When Mr. Hope died in 1839, his three nephews were willed all of his possessions, but the division of his gem collection was not detailed when settling the estate. Hence, a feud between the three nephews began over the gem collection. Like, who was going to get what? And I can imagine, like, this was definitely a brutal feud. It lasted for 10 years, guys. There was 10 long years of arguments and negotiations. And of course, in the background, there's this curse that's, you know, just there, hanging out, ready to do something crazy, ready to stir the pot. So what I can imagine, like 10 years of fighting over jewels, like how many awkward Thanksgivings were there in this time period? Like, I can imagine, I mean, I'm just picturing my own family fighting over, I mean, not that we would, I don't see us doing that, but like if we were, I'm honestly picturing a Succession-like family, like that family from Succession. Darn, what is their last name? Roy is their last name, right? In Succession. So I'm picturing that family like fighting. It's just like tensions are high at probably every family gathering. Like what were their kids thinking? Like everyone was probably a mess during this time, but after 10 years, I can imagine their wives had something to do with this. Like, come on, guys, get over it. Just someone take the damn jewels. Like, I don't know. I feel like 10 years is a long time to be fighting over something. But anyway, they settled. And Henry Thomas Hope ended up with the Hope Diamond and seven other precious gems. When Henry Thomas died in 1862, he left his assets to his wife, Anne Adele Hope, who then willed all of the family heirlooms to her grandson, Lord Francis Hope. And Lord Francis Hope unknowingly would become the next victim of the curse in 1887. So quick pause. Everyone died, like, so far. Like, even these people, Henry Thomas and Anne Adele. So then they just pretty much were giving it to the next person that was alive that could have it. So Lord Francis Hope, let's talk about him. He led a life of luxury well beyond his means, and he was soon in such financial trouble that he begged his family, the ones that were still alive, to let him sell the Hope Diamond in 1901, which must have been so embarrassing for him to like get to a point where like you're a rich kid, you've been given an inheritance, and you have to now sell this diamond that's like your family namesake diamond. Like that must be an ultimate low. And I don't even want to know how that feels. But while they agreed and the diamond was sold, his attempts were fruitless because he still died a very poor man. Lord Francis's wife, her name was May Yohe, she was an American actress who befell the same financial ruin as her husband. On top of extreme debt, Lord Francis divorced May in 1902 due to her infidelity. She then married her new lover, only to get divorced before their first anniversary. And the diamond's curse and misfortunes just kept coming. The Hope Diamond changed many hands before finally landing in Cartier's possession in 1910, and each person involved felt its wrath. The list of people the diamond's curse affected was practically endless. And I'm going to list off a few of the people and what tragically happened to them, according to this story. Jacques Collot became clinically insane and died by suicide. Prince Ivan Kavanotsky was viciously slain. Laurence Ledoux was killed by her lover. Simon Montharides drove his car off a cliff, killing his entire family. Abu Sabir was tortured and imprisoned. Kaloub Bey was hanged in the street by a Turkish mob. Sultan Abdul Ahmed of Turkey killed his favorite Subaya, who wore the diamond. He was then dethroned. Salim Habib ran into financial troubles as well and died at sea off the coast of Singapore. And these terrible things happened one after the other, at least according to Mei Yohi. So the actress, she was the one who provided this lengthy list. This long-winded, historical yet extremely embellished tale, everything I just told you guys up to this point, is ultimately what convinced Evelyn McLean to purchase the Hope Diamond from Pierre Cartier in 1912. Cartier spun this tale and Evelyn ate it out of the palm of his hand, and soon the diamond was hers. This cursed conversation piece was hers. And while Evelyn thought she was immune to the curse, she ended up being one of the most infamous victims yet. She'd wear the Hope Diamond frequently to events and the lavish high society parties that she hosted, but tragedy struck while she owned the diamond. Evelyn's firstborn son died in a car crash when he was a young boy. Her husband Ned left her for another woman and was later declared clinically insane. And her only daughter committed suicide at the age of 25. Which, heartbreaking, very terrible events. But some would say she kind of set herself up for that, right? By purchasing a cursed diamond? Is it truly a diamond with a deadly reputation, or are these stories simply the result of people muddying what actually happened to align with a so-called curse? Confirmation bias, they call it, or kind of like a game of telephone, that game we used to play when we were kids, where like someone would start with a phrase and then you'd go down the line, and as it goes, like you'd whisper it into the next person's ear, and by the time it gets to the end of the line, it doesn't sound anything like it did in the beginning. You know, over time, stories tend to get embellished and muddied and taken out of context. So do you think that's what's to blame here, or is it really a curse? Either way, whatever you believe, there is one story left to tell. Not the story of the curse, per se, but the story of the diamond, what actually happened. And you can kind of, well, I guess we will as we go, we'll compare this story to the story I just told you and identify what's true and what's false. My favorite game. We need to rewind, retrace our steps, and debunk some myths along the way. You can call us Mythbusters, one of my favorite shows growing up. Let's travel back in time one more time to explorer Jean-Baptiste Tavernier in the 1660s. The fate of the diamond story all starts with this guy. It's believed that Tavernier actually found the original 115-carat diamond in India from the Kalar mine between 1664 and 1668, rather than from a Hindu statue. If you recall, I told you guys that the curse pretty much began because this guy, this explorer, Tavernier, stole something that didn't belong to him from this sacred Hindu statue. He plucked the blue diamond out of the eyeball of the statue. From what we could find, that actually did not happen. He found it the old-fashioned way, or the normal way, just by going to a mine and getting it there. So there's no proof of the other, sexier story happening. And so without some angry Hindu priest putting a curse on the diamond because it was stolen from this sacred statue, there's theoretically no curse to be had. In 1669, Jean-Baptiste Tavernier did meet with King Louis, so that was true. And King Louis, as we remember, was famously fond of rare gems and diamonds, and he has been referred to as the Sun King because of his outward displays of wealth to signify his power from God. So he was also, in fact, delusional. Naturally, King Louis was smitten with this rare blue diamond and bought it and several others from Tavernier. And he was so thrilled about this, so jazzed that he got these diamonds from this great explorer, Tavernier, he actually honored Tavernier for his discovery by making him a nobleman. And accounts from that time indicate that Tavernier lived to be 84 years old, which was really old for that time, honestly. Like, that's kind of crazy. Like, that was the equivalent of living to, like, 100 and something today, because they had terrible health back then. So that being said, there's no evidence that he ever got torn apart by dogs on a random trip to Russia. It actually sounds like his life ended up being okay, being promoted to a nobleman and living so long and all, so consider that myth busted. Tavernier was not the first victim of the curse, after all. King Louis XIV recut the diamond down to that 69-carat French blue, as it was called, and its setting was into gold and mounted on a stick. So it was the scepter, as we discussed before. Now let's not forget about Nicolas Fouquet, the throne's superintendent of finances. I told you guys earlier in Cartier's version of events that he borrowed the diamond to wear it to an event, and then went through all sorts of trouble, got like banished and thrown into prison and all this stuff. Well, that is not actually what happened. So he was imprisoned not for randomly wearing the French blue diamond to a party, but rather for embezzling funds. A pretty terrible thing to do when you are literally the throne's superintendent of finances. I'm sure we can all agree with that. So of course something bad's going to happen to you. We now also know that the French blue wasn't worn at all during this time because it was a scepter. It was not technically a piece of jewelry, so that kind of debunks that. And so Nicholas was punished appropriately, I think, for embezzling funds in that time period. Like, he's lucky he didn't get beheaded, honestly. He got sent to this prison, which was a very famous prison. It's called the Pignerol Prison. And this was where this very legendary figure in French history resided at this exact time. He was called the Man in the Iron Mask. And for context, this prison, the Pignerol Prison, was essentially the dumping ground exclusively for men who had crossed King Louis XIV and his father, King Louis XIII, during their reigns. So anyone who crossed them would be thrown into this very specific prison. And many of them came from aristocracy and had fallen from grace. So a little bit more about the Man in the Iron Mask, because I know I'm sure some ears perked up when I said that. Like, that sounds very mysterious. Who was this guy, Katie? I'm going to tell you, because this was interesting. It's a little aside in our story, but there's an actual true crime legend over 300 years old about this guy, the Man in the Iron Mask. So during the reign of King Louis XIV, a mysterious man was incarcerated in several prisons throughout France and Italy. He was dubbed the Man in the Iron Mask because the king did not want his identity revealed to the public for whatever reason. The Man in the Iron Mask reportedly had two musketeers by his side at all times, and they were ordered to kill him if he ever removed his mask. So this is very mysterious. Like, all the other prisoners were, you know, their faces were out in the open, and then there's this one guy who was, for some reason, shrouded in secrecy. And it kind of makes me think, just the nature of this, that the king was afraid of him? I don't know. Like, that's just what this signals to me. Like, he was afraid of him, or he was some way ashamed by something about his look or nature. I don't know. Anyway, so who the man was, why he was imprisoned, and why he was kept a secret has become one of the biggest mysteries facing French historians. All of this begs the question, perhaps Nicolas Fouquet, who was there at that exact time and really messed up in the eyes of the king, was this mysterious man in the Iron Mask? We don't know for sure, but food for thought. So Louis XV, at the age of 5, inherited the throne when Louis XIV passed away from gangrene. We know that. That's true. And with the throne, he also inherited the crown jewels. And he, of course, thought the French blue was beautiful, and he wanted it to be mounted into the Order of the Golden Fleece knighthood. What did I call it? Like an emblem or a badge. Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. If you Google a photo, it looks like a badge. They'll call it just the emblem, but that's like kind of very vague. So just picture a badge of sorts. So that was all true. The French blue was mounted into this lavish piece of jewelry. And as Pierre Cartier emphasized in his account, Louis XV, while originally favored, he quickly became the catalyst for the French Revolution. So Pierre was like, perfect, this goes in line with the curse. So that was true, technically. But hence, when King Louis XVI ascended to the throne after Louis XV, and of course he had Marie Antoinette by his side, things were already on a path of self-destruction. Like, it was kind of hard for them to salvage what had already gone so wrong. People were already super pissed. If you've seen any movie about the reign during that time, you would know. But with or without the diamonds, honestly, they were screwed. Like, they didn't need a cursed diamond to further muddy what had already been going on. They were already, something bad was going to happen to them from the start. So the diamond didn't really have any impact on that. But I guess you could say the diamond had impact if you really want, if you're Pierre Cartier and want to make a sale, you could kind of argue that that may have been caused by a curse, but no one really believes that. And so, despite his best efforts, King Louis XVI was unable to change the trajectory of social, economic, and political affairs in France. While he and Marie Antoinette, a queen notorious for spending money that they just did not have, when they decided to flee, they knew they were committing treason. when they were captured and executed in 1793, they were just reaping the oats that they sowed. These two famous deaths associated with the curse, in my opinion, and many people's opinion, were no more bad luck than a kid getting punished for having his hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. Like, they had it coming. And another thing, it is believed to be highly unlikely that Marie Antoinette ever even wore the French blue, because again, it was not a traditional like necklace or anything that could be worn by a woman. You know, it was this emblem for knighthood. Like, it wasn't something that Marie would have worn. And additionally, there's no record of Princess de Lamballe, Marie's friend, wearing the diamond to any balls or anywhere for that matter. Princess de Lamballe suffered her untimely death just by being in the vicinity of them all, like just by being the queen's co-conspirator in their counter-revolutionary schemes. That's why she died. Like, really no record of her wearing this diamond. So where did all this come from? Pierre Cartier, he did some cooking over there, cooked up a story. As it turns out though, the next part of the legend is true. After the king and queen's execution, the French crown jewels were collected by the government and then stored in the royal storehouse for safekeeping. The one that I can't pronounce the name of. That was where they actually were after the beheading of Marie Antoinette and King Louis XVI. In September of 1792, the jewels were stolen in what I could only really describe as the most pathetic yet effective week-long jewel heist I've ever read about. So let's unpack this. It's absolutely insane. Like, this would never happen today. And I can't stress that enough. Okay. So the French crown jewels were stored in a sealed room on the first floor of the royal storehouse. When the first group of thieves infiltrated the room, not one guard knew a robbery was happening right under their noses. Very mysterious. How is that possible? It was on the first floor and it was a sealed room. How did they get in? So the security system in place was laughable. While there were guards on a rotating shift outside of the room, the sealed door prevented them from patrolling inside. So instead of having, like, you know, planting one guy in front of the jewel exhibit, or what do you call it? Like, just where the jewels were behind glass. Like, that would have made a lot of sense. Like, get a guy in there so he can lock eyes with the jewels at all times to make sure it's still there. Like, duh. But no, they're like, perfect. We'll seal this room on this first floor of the building so no one can go in and out. So if thieves are in there, the guards outside would have no idea because they can't get in. But that begs the question, how did the thieves get in? Well, pretty easy. There was no security from the very outside of the building. So outside the room, there were guys, but outside the building, there was no one, which is absurd. And the windows to the jewel room were unbarred. So theoretically, very easy to pop into. I'm picturing, you know, in those spy movies where they take a laser and they like laser a circle in the glass and then they like suction it out and stick their hand in, and like, that's what I'm picturing, even though this was the 1700s, so there's simply no way that that technology was created at this time, but I'm picturing that like a spy movie. Okay, anyway, so it was pretty easy. They climbed into the unmanned room on the first floor through an unbarred window. Like, it's honestly like the jewels were begging to be stolen at this point. Word got out how easy the theft was. So people came back every night between September 11th and September 17th. The more time went on, the more careless the thieves got. So finally, patrol caught on. But by then, the Order of the Golden Fleece badge of diamonds with the French blue in it was long gone. Someone definitely got fired or beheaded over that. Like, how do you let that happen? Appalling. So that being said, the French blue went missing for 20 years. Between 1792 and 1812, there's no record of where the diamond was, who had it, or who recut it into the blue diamond that we know today. So that means the terrible fate of Wilhelm and his son Hendrik Falls, the Dutch jewelers that stole the diamond, recut it, one of them died, one of them committed suicide, that story that I told you earlier, there's no evidence of that actually happening. The diamond was lost for 20 years. No one knows who had it. But one thing we do know to be true, in that 20 years, the diamond went from being 69 carats to 45.5. It is today. Like, something happened. I don't know how or when or who or what, but someone cut it down to 45.5. All we know is a mysterious blue diamond resurfaced in London in 1812. It was much smaller than the French blue, weighing in at just 45.5 carats, so its connection to the French crown jewels didn't occur until many decades later. And here's my opinion, which might be your opinion too, about why it was cut down, because ultimately, or I guess not ultimately, at first thought, I would think to myself, like, why would they be so stupid to cut it down? Because then it's worthless, right? Like, why would they do that? Maybe they wanted another piece of the diamond to keep and then they'll sell part of it. Or like, I don't know, my brain was going through all the options here, all of the plausible options as to why they did that. But then I realized, I'm like, wait a minute. No, they did it because they, you know, they stole it. It was a dirty diamond because they stole it and they didn't want people to know that it was the stolen diamond, obviously, because if you cut it down, like, oh, it might be just another diamond, you know, another blue diamond that isn't the French blue. And I was right because, or I guess I could be right because many decades later was when they figured it out. A jeweler by the name of John Francion is the first known person to document the recut French blue resurfacing. His findings, get this, guys, were dated just 2 days after the 20-year statute of limitations for crimes committed during the French Revolution had passed. Let me say that one more time, because this just backs up my theory. Okay, John Francion's documents announcing that the lost diamond had been found were dated just 2 days after the 20-year statute of limitations for crimes committed during the French Revolution had passed. It seems too big of a coincidence in my mind that the diamond resurfaced just days after the possibility of prosecution for these crimes was over. In fact, it's believed that it was not a coincidence at all. Again, my theory. The owner probably knew of the diamond's complicated history and didn't want it to be unveiled until they could guarantee that they would not be identified, named, and tried for French war crimes. Because, like, who would want to be involved in French war crimes? Does not sound ideal to me. They probably had it in, like, a safety deposit box or something, or in their underwear drawer for 20 years. Like, imagine having a priceless gem in your home, in your possession, for 20 years. And you, like, couldn't wear it out in public, of course. Or I guess you could. I don't know. Maybe it was worn out and no one knew because it was so much smaller they didn't realize. So moving on, regardless of the diamond's whereabouts for that 20-year span, the story of the diamond's curse that we talked about before never mentioned one particular character, Dr. Daniel Eliason. He was the owner of the diamond in 1812, according to a memo by John Francion. Mr. Eliason was also referenced as the owner by James Sowerby in 1817 and John Maw in 1813 and 1815. These are authors and esteemed gemologists of their time, so they're widely viewed as trusted sources for this sort of thing. Not much else was documented about the mysterious Mr. Eliason, but from what we can gather, nothing mysteriously terrible happened to him, and he's missing from the original tale of the curse. So maybe he was deemed not tragic enough to mention because nothing bad reportedly happened to him. Maybe he was conveniently left out of the story because he didn't fit. He didn't fit the story. He didn't fit the curse. So Cartier was like, no, not interesting enough. Let's cut him from the story. Like a play. The next verified owner of the diamond after Daniel Eliason was the Hope family, of course, for which the diamond got its namesake. The diamond was first documented in 1839 as part of Philip Hope's gem collection. That was said before. Just like the French royal family, the Hope diamond was passed through several generations, and while the selling story banks on the misfortunes of the Hope clan, nothing is outside the realm of normalcy for any family, let alone a wealthy family. Henry Thomas Hope and his wife Anne Adele Hope did end up with the Hope Diamond after 10 years of negotiations, awkward Thanksgivings, and estate lawyers, and they did indeed pass the diamond on to their grandson, Lord Francis Hope, and his wife, actress May Yohe. But the financial ruin that led to the sale of the diamond in 1901 was their own doing. It's doubtful that the diamond caused their bankruptcy. They lived extremely lavishly and well beyond their means, despite the fact that Lord Francis had gotten a hefty inheritance that could have been stretched to satisfy a comfortable life for literally the rest of his life, like the rest of his existence. He could have lived comfortably, but greed got the best of him and it ended up resulting in him having to sell the diamond. So I don't think that was the diamond's fault, per se. May Yohe is an interesting character in this story. You might remember I said earlier she is an American actress, or was, sorry, a long time ago. She was an American actress and wife of Lord Francis Hope, but some dramatic things happened in their marriage, and she ultimately got divorced, or was divorced by him because she cheated on him, on Lord Francis Hope. So kind of drama, dramatic things happened in that marriage. It's believed that Mei Yohe was at the root of all of this. Rumblings of the cursed diamond most likely originated directly from her. I mean, think about it. In a span of a few years, Mei Yohe went from broken, jobless, to divorced, to married, to divorced again. Instead of owning up to her mistakes, maybe admitting that some of this might be because of her, like she might be the root of this, not a curse, she monetized her ties with the Hope Diamond in an attempt to revive her acting career. In 1921, Mei Yohe even memorialized the curse by writing a book and a screenplay detailing her woeful life as a cursed woman. She claimed to have warned the Hope Diamond to numerous parties and public events, which, in her opinion, is why the curse affected her so greatly. Ironically, though, get this, T, Lord Francis Hope famously said that not one person ever wore the Hope Diamond while he was the owner from 1887 to 1901. But after all, like I said, Mei Yohe was an actress. She told a very convincing story, even though the facts say otherwise. Between 1901 and 1910, stories involving the Hope Diamond ran rampant in the media because of Mei Yohe. Her book detailed an extensive list of cursed victims, which is the list that I read from earlier, and many turned out to be exaggerations of the truth or flat-out lies. Instead of being passed from sultans to obscure collectors, the Hope Diamond has a more humble reality. So here it is. This is the true story, like where the diamond went between all these years and before it ended up with Evelyn. So Lord Francis Hope, down on his luck, sold the diamond. We know that. He sold it to London diamond merchant Adolf Weil. Mr. Weil quickly sold the diamond to Joseph Frankel's Sons and Company of New York. So it was going from the UK to the US for the first time. This is notable. Simon Frankel, an American, traveled to London to personally bring the Hope Diamond back to the U.S. with him. The transaction was finalized at a whopping $250,000 in 1901, and of course I calculated that into today's money because I love seeing how different it was today, or if it is today versus then. So back then, $250,000, 1901. Today, that would be $9 million. So a lot of money. Oh my God, I can't even fathom that much money. So the Frankels then owned the diamond from 1901 to 1908. While there was interest in the diamond, there were no legitimate offers to purchase it until Salim Habib in 1908. Mr. Habib was a Turkish diamond collector, and he bought the Hope Diamond for a reported $200,000. So honestly, a bit of a steal, because it was previously purchased for $250,000 and he got it for $200,000. So maybe something was up there. They just wanted to get rid of it. I don't know. But back then it was $200,000. Today that would be $6.7 million. So again, a lot of money. $6.7 mil. This diamond collector. Like, must be nice to just be able to throw that amount of money on a rock, which I'm saying that to be funny. It's actually an incredible diamond. So it was worth that, I guess. Anyway, not even a year later, in June 1909, Mr. Habib was forced to sell his collection to C.N. Rosenau due to financial troubles. The icing on the cake was that the New York Times incorrectly reported that Mr. Habib died in a shipwreck. You might recall I said earlier that was like his part of the curse, or the way the curse took him was via shipwreck. That never happened. It was incorrectly reported about. But despite being untrue, it just added fuel to the curse's fire in the media. Cartier then enters our story. He bought the Hope Diamond from Rosenau in 1910. And so things have kind of come full circle. Pierre Cartier's mission was clear. It was to sell the heck out of this blue diamond no matter what. As proven by Cartier's need for storytelling, the diamond industry at this time was reportedly slow. So things were kind of dry, and he wanted to spice things up by crafting this elaborate tale. The Hope Diamond, in truth, did not pass hands as often as the curse made it seem in that last decade. It did, however, make its way through almost every major jewelry house in the world before finally landing with the Macleans. We already know the tragic ending to Evelyn and Ned McLean's tale, which unfortunately was true. But what happened to the Hope Diamond since Evelyn died in 1947? Enter a new character in our story, American jeweler Harry Winston, who is referred to as the King of Diamonds. And you might have heard of Harry Winston. I think like the first time I ever heard about him was, I think, like Kate Hudson or someone like in that realm of famousness wore Harry Winston to a premiere or something. And I was like, oh, what's Harry Winston? It's a jewelry house. It's a very established jewelry house named after the guy, Harry Winston, who I want to tell you guys a little bit about him because his story is actually very interesting. So before Harry Winston was dubbed the King of Diamonds, he was just the son of Jewish immigrants. While growing up, Harry worked in his father's small jewelry shop. And when he was 12 years old, he somehow recognized a 2-carat emerald in a pawn shop, bought it for 25 cents, so about $8 in today's money, and sold it 2 days later for $800, so 26 grand today. Absolutely insane. He was 12 years old, and he was able to spot a rogue emerald. Honestly, this is the energy that I feel like I have, like delusionally, when I walk into an antique shop. I'm like, I'm gonna like pick up something that I think is ugly and it's gonna be worth like $1 million. But he actually did it. Like he actually, well, I guess an emerald is not ugly, but you know what I mean? Like he had an eye for jewels at a young age. Like you can't teach that sort of thing. It's just you're born with it, I guess, sometimes. And so Harry Winston started his jewelry business in 1920 and opened his first store in New York City in 1932. And by 1949, he was successful enough to buy Evelyn's entire jewelry collection from her and included it in his Court of Jewels, which was a traveling exhibition of gems. In 1958, Harry so graciously donated the Hope Diamond to the Smithsonian Institution, and it's now on display at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. And I'm actually really curious about that. Like when a jewelry house, or I don't know if it was like his personal collection or his like business collection of jewels that this came from, but like, is he compensated for that? Like when you give, like gift a museum a gem, like are you compensated in any way? Or is it just like truly out of the goodness of your heart that you're doing this? Like, I'm actually curious about that. And I don't know, maybe he got like a tax deduction or something. Like, I feel like people don't do this just to be, I mean, sometimes they do, but there has to be like, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch, they say. So I'm curious about that, but I'll research that later on. Anyway, so the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History is where the gem is now, the Hope Diamond as we know it. And I went on a school field trip when I was like 13 and saw it myself. And I have a picture on some ancient digital camera, like somewhere with a glass glare and everything of this diamond. And you know, it's just crazy like thinking about it today because I was looking at photos for the sake of this story and I recognize it like clear as day. I remember it in my mind, what it looks like, the case that it's in. Like it's so clear to me in my mind, in my memory, because it's that memorable of a gem. It is this beautiful thing and beautiful things make people go crazy. So it's no surprise to me that this curse was concocted because, you know, people lose it over these beautiful things, especially when it's not getting the traction that you want. Like Cartier, when he was trying to sell this diamond to Evelyn, reports say that the diamond industry, especially the colored diamond industry, was slowing at this time. So he needed to act fast and do something to get this beautiful diamond and the money that he thought he deserved from it. So naturally, he created the illusion of this curse. But again, like some crazy things happened in the true story that could be blamed on a curse. Like all these terrible things happening to Evelyn, kind of, I mean, granted, way larger in scale, but the first story I told you guys about, like imagining yourself waking up and spilling the coffee and popping your tire and getting laid off, like, you know, the series of like things happening like that, one after the other, like it makes you think about like what caused this. Like, I wonder if at any point she stopped to think to herself, damn, the Hope Diamond got me. Like I was crazy in thinking that it wouldn't affect me. Like, I wonder if she ever, you know, had regrets, had remorse over purchasing this cursed diamond just because she could, you know? I wonder. Anyway, back to the story, my thoughts aside. A little fun fact, another fun fact. I'm full of fun facts about rare gems, I guess. But another fun fact about the Hope Diamond specifically, in the years after Evelyn McLean owned it, just another character that came in contact with the Hope Diamond, was First Lady Jackie Kennedy. She loaned the Hope Diamond to the Louvre in France in 1962 for an exhibit showcasing 10 centuries of French jewels, in which the Hope Diamond was reunited with the other French crown jewels, including the other stones in the stolen Order of the Golden Fleece badge, for the first time in 170 years. Which, for some reason, when I first read that, I was like, that is adorable. Like, how cute. The Hope Diamond was reunited with its friends, like, that it hasn't seen, and it was stolen away from them, and I don't know why I'm getting so invested in this diamond, I, like, actually have feelings for it. So, okay, reeling it back in, it seems like we have debunked the Hope Diamond's curse, right? The Cartier and Winston families at the tail end of our story seem to have gotten out relatively unscathed, like, nothing really crazy happened to them. But one important character in our story remains. James Todd, the local letter carrier who delivered the diamond to the Smithsonian, is the final piece of this puzzle. On November 8, 1958, an employee of Harry Winston's New York City jewelry store mailed an ordinary-looking package at the Mail City post office. Yes, a literal, guys, a brown paper package. Like, practically shipped this diamond in a brown paper bag. Like, no bulletproof case, no, like, Secret Service delivery. Like, I'm picturing something so high-tech, like, or high security, and that just didn't exist. Like, that didn't happen. I don't know who decided. Harry Winston was like, perfect, we'll just ship it in a brown paper bag, but they did. Miraculously, it survived. It traveled safe and sound through the U.S. mail and into the hands of James Todd, who's the local letter carrier, who then delivered the brown paper package to the Smithsonian. But, get this, within a year of delivering the Hope Diamond to the Smithsonian, James Todd crushed his leg and injured his head in 2 car accidents. His wife had a fatal heart attack, his dog strangled himself when getting wrapped up in his leash, and his home caught on fire. I don't want to say it. I don't want to be the one to say it, but dare I say, he was affected by the curse. The Hope Diamond curse affected him. And this is why this happened. Like, one could say, I mean, that's a series of really unfortunate events, one after the other. What else do you blame in that instance, you know? So, on that cheerful note, I will let you decide. Do you believe in curses? If the Hope Diamond now, I mean, because it's a part of the Smithsonian and it was a donation, it technically belongs to the public. So are we all suffering the wrath of the cursed Hope Diamond? Can I blame my spilled coffee, flat tire, and layoff on a curse? And not just any curse, the Hope Diamond curse. I'll let you decide. That was my very first episode of Found Objects Podcast. How did I do? If you ever get a chance to go to the Smithsonian in D.C., definitely check out the Hope Diamond. It's still there. And again, I have photos over on the Instagram, Found Objects Podcast Instagram, that depicts the diamond then, back in time when we first started the story, and then also now. So definitely check that out. But yeah, cursed diamond. Food for thought, guys. What do we think? Do we think it was cursed? Do we think it was just a magnificent sales pitch? You tell me. Thank you guys for listening, and tune in next Wednesday for another episode of Found Objects Podcast. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.